From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. If you listened to the radio in the early days of rock and roll, you probably heard Laverne Baker. Her records included the R&B hits Bumblebee and Jim Dandy. On this edition of Fresh Air, we catch up with Laverne Baker. Also today, economist Robert Reich on why the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. And book critic Don Leonard tells us what he thinks of the violence in Bret Easton Ellis' new novel, American Psycho. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House said today the United States would not become involved in the internal strife in Iraq. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Amid the reports that Saddam Hussein is close to putting down the Shiite rebellion in southern Iraq, presidential spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says the U.S. will not take any action in support of the rebels. U.S. forces have shot down two Iraqi jets, but Fitzwater declined to say that any action will be taken against Iraqi helicopters, some of which have been used against the rebels. The spokesman said the jets were considered an immediate threat to Allied forces, while the slower-flying helicopters are not as worrisome. President Bush has encouraged the Iraqi people to rise up against Saddam Hussein, and the rebels have publicly requested U.S. assistance. But a senior administration official said involvement in the internal conflict represents a trap for the United States. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
The leaders of two conflicting Yugoslav republics have agreed to work for a peaceful resolution of the nation's problems. Officials said that Croatian President Franjo Tudjman met last night with Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic on the border of the two republics. Croatia's nationalist government has been at odds with the hardline communist leadership of Serbia. Some say their dispute over the future of the Yugoslav Federation has brought the country to the verge of a civil war. A meeting of the presidents of all six Yugoslav republics has been set for Thursday. Israeli Foreign Minister David Levy has rejected American criticism of Israel's planned deportation of four Palestinian activists in the Gaza Strip. The four began an appeal today to an Israeli military court. Linda Gradstein has more from Jerusalem.
The foreign minister said deportations are a necessary part of Israel's war against terrorism. American officials have sharply criticized the move, saying it is against international law and will be an obstacle to peace. Levy angrily responded, saying, "If standing up to terror is an obstacle to peace, then Israel will just have to raise its hands and surrender." Defense Minister Moshe Aaron said deportations are the most effective deterrent against violence. In the past month, six Jews have been stabbed to death by Arabs. Tomorrow, the Israeli cabinet will vote on new measures restricting Palestinians' access into Israel. Police Minister Rani Milo will ask the government to ban any unmarried Arabs under age 30. Palestinians say this would make their already difficult economic situation even worse. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The Supreme Court ruled today that U.S. firms don't have to abide by American civil rights laws in foreign countries. The court said that American citizens working for U.S. companies overseas are not protected by a provision of the 1964 Civil Rights Act barring racial, sexual, religious, or national bias on the job. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 49 points today to close at 2,914.85. This is NPR News. The Supreme Court ruled today that criminal defendants whose coerced confessions were improperly used as evidence may not necessarily be entitled to a new trial. The ruling came on a 5-4 vote, pitting conservative justices appointed by Presidents Nixon, Reagan, and Bush against the court's moderates. The majority said that coerced confessions may be viewed as a harmless error if other evidence at the trial was enough to convict the defendant. Dissenters said that the ruling upset one of the fundamental tenets of American criminal justice. When Army Specialist Anthony Riggs was gunned down last week on a Detroit street after returning home from the Gulf War, his death sparked a national outcry. Now, police have charged the soldier's wife and brother-in-law with his murder. Don Gagne of Michigan Public Radio reports.
It was first thought that 22-year-old Anthony Riggs' death was the work of a car thief, but now police say this was a domestic dispute. the widow in this case, 21-year-old Tony Riggs, was today charged with premeditated murder, as was her 19-year-old brother Michael Cato. Detroit Police Inspector Jerry Stewart says the turning point in their investigation was the recovery of the murder weapon. The handgun was found two blocks from the crime scene in a garbage can.
The weapon was located the day that we recovered the car, and it was traced through several hands, so finally it was traced to Michael.
According to published reports, Anthony and Tony Riggs were known to be having marital difficulties, but police have declined to discuss possible motives. For National Public Radio, I'm Don Gagne in Detroit.
A study released today said as many as 5.5 million American children suffer from hunger. The study was conducted by the Food Research and Action Center, a nutrition advocacy group, and said that one American child in every 8 comes from a family so poor that little money is left for food after housing costs are paid. The report said that hungry children are more likely to become ill and more likely to miss school. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Laverne Baker is one of the rhythm and blues stars of the 50s and early 60s, about whom you might ask, where is she now? Well, the answer is, she's back in the States performing, and she's our guest today. Baker is one of Atlantic Records' first big success stories, with hits like Jim Dandy, Tweedledee Dee, and Bumblebee. And it was Atlantic Records that revived her career in 1988 by having her perform in their 40th anniversary celebration at Madison Square Garden. More recently, she performed in the Broadway R&B review Black and Blue, and she recorded a song for the Dick Tracy soundtrack. I'll let Laverne Baker explain where she was in the intervening 20 years after we hear this 1956 recording.
Jim Dandy to the rescue. Jim Dandy to the rescue. Jim Dandy to the rescue. Go, Jim Dandy. Go, Jim Dandy. Jim Dandy on a mountaintop. 30,000 feet to drop. Spot a lady on a runaway horse. Aha, that's right, of course. Jim Dandy to the rescue. Go, Jim Dandy. Go, Jim Dandy. Jim Dandy met a girl named Sue. She was feeling a kind of blue. Jim Dandy, he's the kind of guy. Never liked to see a little girl cry. Jim Dandy to the rescue. Go, Jim Dandy. Go, Jim Dandy. Jim Dandy to the rescue. Jim Dandy to the rescue. Jim Dandy to the rescue. Go, Jim Dandy. Go!
Laverne Baker, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Now, you just performed last weekend at the Village Gate, a club in New York. What did you sing? What's in your repertoire now?
Well, right now, the people are so interested in hearing my old recordings. So that's basically what I'm doing with a few other songs. But I'm putting my act together for California, which I will be doing other songs to show the versatility of my voice, you know, and things that I can do, which I would like to do here. But the people, I know, God bless them, they just want to hear what they like. So that's what I do here is I do a few outsiders, you know, but basically the act I'm doing now is from the 50s and all of my hits.
Now, in the 20 years or so that you weren't performing in the States, you were living in the Philippines?
Yes, I'm the show director for the United States Marine Corps. I'm still active in show business. I book all the shows in the club, and on Fridays and Saturdays, I sing myself. I do 4 sets on Friday, 4 sets on Saturday. And for the happy hour, you know, I laugh and talk with the guys, go around, you know. It makes them feel good and keeps up the morale. That is my job, to make everybody laugh and happy, and it has been very successful there.
What kind of other talent did you book for the shows?
Well, I booked all Filipino talent, and I had all the agents. I have a vast list of agents that I deal with by phone, and some of them, if they have the money, they come down. And we book whatever I think is suiting for the club. You know, if they've had too much singing, then I'll bring in, like, acrobats and tumblers and stuff like that. And if I think they've had too much of female, I'll bring in a mixed show, like the Philippine cultural dances and stuff like that. It's whatever I feel that we're needed, you know. And it's like if the ships are coming in, then I book the show full of beautiful girls because the guys don't want to see no guys, you know. So when the carriers are coming in, it's quite wild there. You know, we have sometimes like 8,000 guys at one time, you know, in there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, let's listen to another one of your hit records from the 1950s before we talk some more. And why don't we listen to Bumblebee?
Oh, wow.
I think, you know, this is kind of a novelty record, but it's a wonderful recording.
Yes, I'm singing it now, and I feel so very, very funny singing that.
Why do you feel funny about it?
Well, because I was, you know, very, very young, and at the time it fitted me, you know. It was good, and I had a big hit with it with the kids. But now I'm much older. I feel funny singing it, you know, but I'll do it. You know, I do it. And I'm surprised that my voice can reach the squeaky part now. I still can do it. So I do it. You know, if someone asks for it, I'll do it.
So do you do it differently?
No, I do it the same. The same. I do all of my recordings identical, the same. Matter of fact, I have hired two backup singers to do the background so that the people will know, you know, what they heard before. It still sounds the same.
Okay, let's listen to Laverne Baker, and this is Bumblebee.
Shut, shut, shut.
I'm gonna have to put you
shut,
down.
Shut, shut.
You've been treating me like a
shut,
child.
Shut, shut.
You know you've hurt me once before.
Shut, shut.
You'll never hurt me anymore.
Shut, shut.
Evil bumblebee.
Shut, shut.
I gave you love as sweet as honey.
Shut, shut.
My life, my soul, and all my money.
Shut, shut.
You didn't seem to realize
shut, shut.
You had a home in paradise.
Shut, shut. Shooey, you hurt me like a bee.
A bumblebee, an evil bumblebee. Don't you know I cry? Just one kiss before you go. Don't ever come back no more. Now, baby, there's no need of crying.
Shut, shut.
I'm sick and tired.
So my guest Laverne Baker is recorded in 1960. Now, Laverne Baker, you were born in Chicago, and you started performing in your teens.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And when you started performing in clubs around Chicago, you were known as Little Miss Sharecropper. Who gave you that name?
Regretfully, yes. Some guy. Well, it was a long story. It's like at the big club, De Lisa, which was the place during those early 40s, 50s in Chicago. And they had a singer there named Little Miss Cornshuck. And she was a great singer. And she used to come out with a little, like Bo Peep outfit on with a little basket and mm-hmm. ribbons in her hair. And she was, quite famous. Her name was the Talk of Chicago. And she got on the wrong path, you know, and wasn't able to perform. So then they were looking for someone to take her place. So I met this guy at another one of our big clubs. I had went to see the show, and I did a guest number. And he said, you know, they're looking for a good singer at Club De Lisa. So I was a little nervous to go to the breakfast dance because I didn't have no business out that, you know, all night long at that during those years, you know, because the breakfast dance started at 6 o'clock in the morning. But I slipped and went anyway, and I got the job. And the next thing I knew, they had put these little costumes and ribbons and baskets in my hand, and they called me Little Miss Sharecropper because they couldn't use Corn Shuck. You know, and Sharecropper was related to that. But about 2 years after I left, I hurried up and got rid of it. So,
did you protest when they wanted to outfit you that way? And
no,
call you
I
that?
Didn't. You know, you got to get your foot in the door before you can say anything in regards to what you do. You know, I wasn't strong. I just wanted to get started, and I didn't care how, you know, as long as it was legit, you know. So they wanted me to sing. And hey, I enjoyed it for a while, you know. But then as I started to mature, you know, and I saw other singers, you know, looking so beautiful on stage, I didn't like it anymore.
Now, I want to read you a review from Variety. And this is from 1954, the year that you signed with Atlantic.
Wow.
And this is a review of you at the Apollo.
Oh, I see.
And the reviewer wrote, "She's a strong-voiced looker who embellishes her singing with movement and suggestiveness worthy of any grind artist. And while this goes well at the Apollo, she'll have to hold back in other situations." weird review, but I was wondering, you know, what were you doing in your act then, and did you have to change what you were doing
yes,
in terms of emotions?
Yes. When as you mature, you know, like for one-nighters, and the Apollo, that was great, you know?
What were you doing?
I have a thing I do. I turn around and my behind moves, you know, and stuff like that. You know, I still can do it. You know, it's all muscle control type thing, you know. But the audience go crazy when you do this, you know, and the young audiences back then in rock and roll. And at that time, I was not playing sophisticated and big nightclubs. I was doing strictly one-nighters and theaters. So I had to stick to it. But, you know, as I got a little older, I wanted to change, and I did change. And I made it. I went to Basin Street East with Louis Armstrong more than one time, you know. And I played Vegas. And these are rooms and things that I could not get when I was in rock and roll. So I had to change my act, you see.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were one of the first black singers to cross over to a white teenage audience.
Yes.
In the 1950s. Was there a conscious attempt at Atlantic Records to give you certain kind of material or to change your stage act in any way to help you cross over?
No, the music, Atlantic always picked my music, Ahmed and Jerry at the time. They always picked, you know, the songs that they wanted me to sing or they thought that would be best for me. And I never argued at that particular time. I'll fight now, but I didn't argue then. And because they knew what they wanted, you know. But coincidentally, the things that they gave me, I enjoyed doing at that time. So I gave my best at it, you know. And sometimes they would come in the studio and play different things and holler in the background, you know, to make it better, you know, sound like more people.
They'd holler in the background on the record?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Which
yeah.
record do they do that on?
Quite a few. They'd sing with at that time we had a group called, a backup group called the Q's. And a lot of things he'd come in and he'd show them, he'd sing with them to show them what he wanted, you see. And this is the way we worked back then, you know. We had a small room and it was... like they were on one side and we were on the other, and, you know, and we made millions of hits up there in that little hole that we were in.
Now, I want to play Tweedledee D, but, you know, the voices that come in at the beginning,
uh-huh.
They're kind of square-sounding voices, don't you think?
Yes, yeah. These are the cues, and one of the cues is the one that wrote Tweedledee D, Mr. Winfield Scott. He's the one that wrote it, and that is the longest recording session I've ever had in my life.
What made it so long?
We did 52 takes.
Whoa, you're kidding.
No, I kid you not.
How come? What went
wrong?
Well,
he wasn't satisfied. It was something missing, and during the break, we know they always give us a little break for tea or whatever, the rest of our voices, you know. And I did, I was kidding with it, and I said, hump, be hump, bump, bump, like that, and Ahmed said, that's it, that's it. That's how that got in there. You know, it was just something missing that he wasn't. And he's like that now, you know. He's like that now. Everybody say he's still the same. If he's in a date and he's not comfortable, you know, he knows what he like, you know. And if he don't hear it, he'll keep pushing, you know. So that's that with the Tweedledee D session. It was very, very long.
Well, why don't we listen to Tweedledee D? And this is my guest, Laverne Baker.
I'm as happy as can be. Jiminy Cricket, Jiminy Jack, you make my heart go clickety-clack. Tweedledee, Tweedledee, Tweedledee.
This Laverne Baker is recorded in 1955, a song that went up to number 14 on the charts. Big hit for you. Now, how did you feel when you were given the song? Did you like the song?
Yes and no.
What was the yes and what was the no?
Well, because, you know, I told you we did so many takes. And it just didn't make any sense to me, okay? You know, and
but the lyric or the
yeah,
text?
the lyric. The music was okay. We had to find the music to really fit it, you know. So I came up with a suggestion of Brazil. If you notice, it's
at the beginning, yeah.
Yeah, dun 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 dun, 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 dun. So, you know, and that's why I was so upset when Georgia Gibbs covered my record, because we worked very hard to stay away from the main track of Brazil, just a little taste of it, you know. And then she recorded my song word for word. I was very upset with this because she used my arrangement. Use your own arrangement, you know. That was the only kick, because once the song is PD, public domain, anybody can sing it, you know. I was really upset with the arrangement, because we worked very hard on that.
Georgia Gibbs' cover of your record went up to number 2 on the charts.
I know. It was so many people they thought they had the original, and they didn't. They had hers.
Now, she was a white singer.
Yes.
Recording your hit.
Yeah.
Were there stations that would play the white singer's version of it that wouldn't play yours?
Oh, yeah. And there were some of them that played hers, and after they found out she wasn't the original, they wouldn't play it anymore. You know, this happened in the whole state of Illinois and Michigan.
Did you play a lot of the rock and roll shows that were put together by Alan Freed and
yes,
Murray
I
McKay?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
What was it like to perform with those? Who were some of the people who shared the bill with you? And
so many.
What was it? Yeah.
Oh, so many. I wish I had known you were going to ask me that. Let's see. The last show I did with Freed, I think, was at the Brooklyn Paramount. It was Chuck Berry, and I got my eyes closed trying to remember this. It was Chuck Berry, Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, the Everly Brothers, Paul Anka, Screamin' Jay Hawkins, Bill Doggett. Oh, quite a few. I can't remember them all.
What a show.
Yeah, he used to carry, we had 2 busloads full to capacity and maybe 4 cars all the time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Laverne Baker, and she had a lot of hits in the 1950s, early 60s, songs like Tweedledee Dee, Bumblebee, Jim Dandy, I Cried a Tear. And she's back in the States after about 20 years and performing again, and her hits have just been reissued on compact disc. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Laverne Baker is my guest. In the 1950s, you recorded an entire album of Bessie Smith songs.
Oh, I loved it. Now, that's a recording date I enjoyed. I really did enjoy it. I loved the songs. And after I listened to Bessie Smith, and even now that I'm older, when I do her numbers, I sound more like her, you know. I was told that by the bass player and some of the guys who actually worked with Bessie Smith, that was still living, Atlantic got some of the original guys that played with her, you know, and they told me, said, man, you really sound like Bessie, you know. I just had one of those big growling voices, I guess, you know, and it's worse now that I'm older.
Well, it's a great album, and it was reissued recently on compact disc.
Yeah.
So let's play something off of it. This is the opening track, and this is Pigfoot.
Oh.
Guns. We're gonna be resting when the wagon comes.
sounds really terrific. Was Bessie Smith a big influence on you?
No. Let's say singers from that era did, you know. And then my mom and my grandmom, they were all gospel singers in church. So naturally, I grew up in church, you know, that's where most of us come from, you know.
What was it like for you in the 60s when you stopped having hit records and when the kind of records making the pop charts were changing?
Well, I tell you what, I was a smart cookie. I left before it stopped. I realized it was getting slow, and I guess the good Lord was with me. My Asian tour came in right in the middle of that. And I said, well, let me get this, because in Asia, and you're playing the military bases, and they know you, you know, and at that time, you know, it was great, and I had a good show put together. So I really forgot all about it, you know.
This was what, a USO tour?
No, I don't do USO. I go over independently and by myself, you know, and I travel from, my tour went from Tokyo to Vietnam and back again to Guam.
So are you still living in the Philippines?
Yes, I still maintain my kids are there, and but I'm going to go and close out my house and file my petition to get my baby out, because my baby is half-half. She's half Filipino and half American. So I have to go through quite a bit to get her papers ready to get her out of the Philippines, and then I will resign my post, because I still carry my contract and ID cards for the base. And then my mother wants me to come home, so I think I'll come home for whatever time God has for me left. I will spend it here in America.
Will you be recording again soon?
I pray so. Well, I just had a new release, which I'm grateful was released last Wednesday, a CD of all my, some of my old hits, released by Warner Atlantic, you know, they're together. And it's on sale here in New York now. I don't know about other cities, but you can get it. It's got Tweely D, I Cried a Tear, and so forth and so on. It's a reissue, you know, but it's on CD.
Great.
Uh-huh. But we're going to do some more, and I'm hoping to do some more recording. I have several offers, but I'm still holding out because I want to stay with Atlantic if I can. They're lucky for me, you know?
Yeah.
They have been very great for me, you know? So, well, you know, I don't mind. I want to try something of the new stuff. You know, if I can't make it, then I can't make it. But I would like to try. I'm the type, I'll try it, you know. I'm not a giver up. I fight, you know. And I want to make a rap record.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I want to rap with something in my groove, you know, just to fight back with the youngsters.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Laverne Baker, I thank you very much for talking with us. It's really been fun to hear from you. Thank you.
And I'd like to thank you very, very much. And you have a nice day.
Laverne Baker will perform at the Village Gate in New York the next 2 weekends, and she'll be in San Francisco and Los Angeles in April. Let's listen to a song that Baker did for the soundtrack of the film Dick Tracy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
We're twisting and we're shaking, but don't you let it break, 'cause I need every ounce of it to bake my cake, 'cause I'm a slow mama, and I need a big long rolling pin to get it ready and just right, woo, for my red hot oven. Honey, let's roll it slow and easy, if it takes all night, 'cause if you try to rush it, it'll never come out right.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A Economist Robert Reich says the top one-fifth of the American population makes as much money as the other four-fifths put together. And the fortunate fifth is quietly seceding from the nation. Coming up, Robert Reich on the growing gap between the haves and the have-nots in our country. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews this year's most controversial novel, American Psycho, by Bret Easton Ellis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Iraqi troops loyal to Iraqi President Saddam Hussein appear to be strengthening their position north of Baghdad in preparation for a counterattack on areas captured by Kurdish forces. Iraqi opposition groups have again accused the military of using air power against the city of Kirkuk. Gerald Butt reports from Nicosia.
According to opposition groups and to reports reaching Iran, Republican Guard units, which were deployed in southern Iraq, now find themselves involved in defending Baghdad and in positions further north, ready to tackle the Kurdish rebellion. For the second straight day, the Kurds have accused the Baghdad authorities of using planes and helicopters to attack the city of Kirkuk. An opposition spokesman said Kirkuk was also coming under long-range artillery fire, apparently in preparation for an army ground attack to try to recapture the city. In the meantime, the Iraqi army is still managing to hold on to Mosul, the major city in the north of the country. It seems likely, indeed, that while the Kurds have had a relatively easy time thus far, progress beyond the line they control now will be very much more difficult. For National Public Radio, this is Gerald Butt in Nicosia.
Iraqi refugees are crowding into a U.S. military checkpoint on the Iraqi-Kuwaiti border. More than 2,000 Iraqis arrived today, stretching the ability of the camp several miles inside Iraq to provide for them. And for the third day in a row, refugees climbed over barbed wire to loot food supplies. Among the latest arrivals at the camp were 500 Iraqi troops, including a brigadier general. In Moscow, Soviet leader Gorbachev has ordered his National Interior Ministry to take control of law enforcement. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
Gorbachev's decree strips Moscow's liberal, anti-communist local government of authority over police functions. The order comes just one day after Gorbachev's cabinet imposed a three-week ban on demonstrations in Moscow, a ban that Gorbachev is more likely to be able to enforce, with the police now answerable to his interior ministry. Several prominent Moscow politicians today condemned the ban on public rallies as unconstitutional. They said they'll go ahead with plans for a mass demonstration on Thursday in support of Russian President Boris Yeltsin. Yeltsin, who is Gorbachev's arch rival, faces a possible no-confidence vote when the Russian parliament convenes in an extraordinary session on Thursday. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
And in New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 49 points to close at 2,914.85 on volume of some 199 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 2-1 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. According to a government spokesman in Singapore, troops stormed a hijacked Singapore Airlines airplane, and all four hijackers are dead. Hijackers of the plane with 129 people on board had demanded the release of a number of people held in Pakistan, including the husband of former Prime Minister Bhutto. State officials in Utah say that their restrictive abortion law may have to be revised. Abortion rights groups charge that the law could lead to murder charges and executions for women seeking illegal abortions. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Salt Lake City.
Utah has the most restrictive abortion law in the country, and it unintentionally makes illegal abortion a capital offense. That's what abortion rights groups say after analyzing the new anti-abortion law and the state's criminal code. State officials say they don't intend to file murder charges or seek the death penalty for illegal abortions, but they acknowledge that that's now possible. So they'll ask the state legislature to revise the abortion law in a special legislative session next month. State lawmakers will also be asked to clarify the law. It allows abortions in cases of reported incest, But lawyers for the American Civil Liberties Union say women victimized by brothers, uncles, or cousins would not be allowed abortions under the law. Lawsuits are expected to keep the statute in the courts for years. I'm Howard Berkus in Salt Lake City.
And the International Air Transport Association says that airlines lost more than $2 billion in the first 2 months of this year because of higher fuel expenses and fewer passengers. The association says at the height of the Persian Gulf War last month, airlines lost well over $1 billion. Higher expenses for airport security and insurance added more cost for airlines. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up, gold prices moved down. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Economist Robert Reich says the war didn't do much to help or hurt the American economy. We had lots of troubles before the war started, and we still have them now that the war's over. One of those problems is the growing gap between the haves and have-nots in America. It's a subject Reich tackles in his new book, The Work of Nations, Preparing Ourselves for 21st Century Capitalism. Reich is a professor at Harvard University and a contributing editor of The New Republic. He worked for both the Ford and Carter administrations. Here's a figure Reich cites to illustrate that growing gap between the haves and the have-nots. Last year, the top fifth of the American population took home more money than the combined income of the rest of the population.
The gap, and that increasingly widening gap between the top 20% and the bottom four-fifths of Americans, derives from the global economy. This is pre-tax, by the way. This isn't as a result of a regressive shift in the tax code, although there has been that regressive shift. What's happening essentially is that if you're highly skilled, if you're highly educated, if you're in the top 20% of the American elite, as it were, professional, managerial, technical, you are in ever greater demand in a world economy that is putting a premium on conceptual problem-solving skills. And therefore, given the integration of the world economy, that is the new transportation communication linkages, the world economy is rewarding you with higher and higher salaries and benefits. Supply and demand, in other words, is working to your advantage. But, and here is the big but, if you are unskilled in the new global economy and you're in the United States, you are competing with millions and millions of unskilled workers who are pouring into the world economy, most of whom are would be delighted to work for a small fraction of the prevailing American wage. Blue-collar jobs are leaving the United States. They're going to Latin America, Southeast Asia, Southern Europe, where workers are willing to work, happy to work, for $2, $3, $4 an hour. And as a result, those old middle-class jobs that you could get without very much education on an American assembly line are simply vanishing. Supply and demand is working against you if you are unskilled, and therefore your wages and benefits are on a downward escalator.
So if you're unskilled, you're up against two problems. One is the difficulty of finding a job in the first place, but there's another difficulty, which is that the job you find might not pay a living wage.
Well, the chances are that the job you find is going to be in the service sector, the local service economy, retail, restaurant, hospital orderly, probably paying maybe $4 an hour, $4.50 an hour, slightly higher than the minimum wage. But this is not going to keep you and your family out of poverty, or it may not. In fact, what we're seeing these days is that in order to maintain family incomes, you have to have two wage earners in most families, whereas 15 years ago, 20 years ago, you could do it with one wage earner. Most Americans are dimly aware of the fact that if you are unskilled, if you're a non-supervisory worker, you now have a wage that, in inflation-adjusted terms, adjusted for inflation, is about what your wage was in 1958. Well, that's a conversation. It's a conversation stopper.
Yeah, I'll say.
And again, it's because of these centrifugal forces in the world economy. The only way out, Terry, it seems to me, I mean, we're going to always have a lot of workers that are in the local service economy, but there are many Americans who could be performing high-value-added complex jobs in the new world economy and be making much, much more money if they had the right education and training, if they had the right to preschool education, if they had all the advantages that many of the people in the top fifth have, but they don't.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Reich, and he's an economist at Harvard University and the author of the new book, The Work of Nations, Preparing Ourselves for 21st Century Capitalism. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Harvard economist Robert Reich is my guest, author of the new book, The Work of Nations. You make the case here that, in fact, the top fifth, the wealthier fifth, the fifth that's making as much money as the other four-fifths put together, that they're quietly seceding from the nation and they're building their own economy, their own little world.
This is happening. I don't mean to blame the top fifth. Many people don't realize who are in the top fifth that this is happening, but they are seceding in the sense that they are less and less dependent on the rest of the four-fifths of the population. They're moving into their own enclaves, their own economic enclaves. You know, zip code marketing is all the rage these days because many marketers know that the best way of reaching affluent households is by zip code. Where you live very much determines how much you make. There's a direct correlation. If you're in the fortunate fifth, you probably have pretty good schools. Some of the best high schools and grammar schools in America are in the suburbs, wealthy suburbs. As the federal government gets out of the education business, as states are hard-pressed and therefore put more and more of the onus of financing education on the local townships, what we find, logically, is that as Americans segregate, the top fifth goes to school districts that can be good, they can afford good schools, the tax base is pretty good. Everybody else is struggling. They're struggling with bad schools that are growing poorer. Private health clubs instead of public parks, private libraries instead of public libraries. You see, again, the top fifth of Americans is seceding into their own worlds in a way that have less and less to do with the world inhabited by most other Americans.
And you see condominiums and residential communities as contributing to this trend. How so?
Well, it's part of the same thing. The growth of residential, private residential communities that pay for people to mend the grass and maintain the lights and maintain the streetlights and maintain the swimming pools and keep the roads in good repair. These are like private little governments, but the difference is that they are financed by people who have seceded, in a way, from public government and created their own little world. The number of private security guards in the United States now exceeds the number of public police officers. And, in fact, in the private sector, private security guards is almost the fastest-growing occupational group.
Do you think this means that the people in the top fifth economically don't care as much about the health of their municipal government, their city government, because they don't rely on it in the way they once did?
They rely on it far less, that's right. And they're paying, they may feel like they're paying more taxes, but actually the top fifth, the tax burden is shifting to the bottom four-fifths, if you include state taxes, local taxes, and also the federal income tax, which compared to what it was in the late 70s is far more regressive. The top fifth is less dependent on the rest of the population, partly because of the global economy. You know, as I mentioned in the book, in the 1830s, to go way back in time, Alexis de Tocqueville, the French magistrate, he was a young man, came over to America and asked himself, why is it that Americans are willing to contribute and sacrifice for the general welfare? Back in Europe, he said, everybody used the excuses in a way. They said it was justified by noblesse oblige, duty, honor, patriotism. He thought that those were very hypocritical reasons. In the United States, when he asked people why they sacrificed so readily for the commonwealth, people said, enlightened self-interest. In the long run, I'll get it back. In the long run, it'll help me, and therefore, if everybody around me is more productive, I'll sacrifice and I'll invest in their education, I'll invest in good municipal government and services, because it'll help me. But in modern America, in an America that is part of a global economy, that rationale may be somewhat less persuasive. My neighbor, Terry, back in Cambridge, is a computer engineer who's working on a project for Siemens, the giant German electronics firm. It's being financed out of Tokyo. The routine computer coding is being done in Bulgaria, and the hardware is being put together in Mexico. My neighbor is sort of a typical, maybe a slightly extreme version, of a new global cosmopolitan player who is less dependent for his economic welfare on the productivity of the future productivity of those kids in the next town, in Chelsea or in Somerville, Massachusetts.
Gee, that's bad news if you can't rely on enlightened self-interest for a few good things.
Well, I wish we could rely, as we could in the 1830s, on enlightened self-interest. I think it's a less powerful motive in the new global economy.
What should the top fifth be held responsible for, held accountable for?
I think that even though America is no longer a unique and separate economy, that is, money and technology and corporations, plant and equipment now go across borders almost at the speed of an electronic impulse, nevertheless, we are still a society in which we have mutual obligations. We have obligations toward one another to invest in the future productivity of one another. I'm not suggesting that we want to merely redistribute income. It's not necessary only to take from the wealthy and give to the needy, although that certainly is a problem. One out of every five American kids is now in poverty, the highest rate of poverty we've had in this country for 25 years. But we also need to expect, and I think even in the long term this is much more important, that the top 20% that now have more income than the bottom four-fifths put together, that they invest in the productivity of the bottom 80%. And that means preschool education. It means Head Start. Head Start, you know, is one of the most successful programs the government has ever put on. Every study shows that the future of those kids that go through a Head Start program is so much more likely to be a positive, productive future than kids that don't. But only about half of the kids who are eligible now have access to Head Start programs. We have a level of infant mortality in this country that puts us number 19 behind 18 other nations. And you can look at other statistics that are just as damning.
Are you making the argument for more taxes on the wealthy for more philanthropy from the wealthy?
It's three things, Terry. It's a tax burden. We have to go to a more progressive tax system, and a lot of those taxes have to go into education and training and public health and infrastructure. We haven't built a new airport in this country since 1974. But we also have to expect from the top 20% more contributions. You know, George Bush talks about 1,000 points of light, but actually there have been fewer and fewer points of light. Charitable contributions by the wealthy tend to go to public charities that more likely than not help the wealthy. That is, I'm talking about concert halls and symphonies, elite universities, places where the wealthy gather, but very little of that charitable contribution from the top 20% goes to help the poor in any genuine, meaningful sense. And finally, we're talking about American corporations and their policies of investing in the American workforce. The relatively uneducated, maybe somebody with just a high school education, investing in their training. Other nations, like Germany, have very elaborate apprenticeship programs in which they take high school dropouts or high school graduates. The public sector, the private sector working together, corporations invest substantially in the training of German youth. Well, we ought to be doing the same thing. We don't do it in this country.
The subtitle of your new book is Preparing Ourselves for 21st Century Capitalism. I take that to mean that you still have faith in capitalism.
Well, capitalism, broadly conceived as a way in which the private sector is the engine of economic development, capitalism has won the race. There's no question anymore. Communism doesn't work. Socialism doesn't work. But that doesn't mean that the public sector has no role to play. And I think often in the United States we tend to forget the fact that the public sector has played and continues to play such a vital role. American corporations in this country last year, one out of every $3 they spent for research and development came from Uncle Sam. In fact, if you look at the three most successful export industries in this country, aerospace, pharmaceuticals, agriculture, we find that Uncle Sam, the federal government, is deeply involved in all three industries. But the point is, we don't do it very well. We don't understand how the public sector ought to be involved. We use the pretext very often of national security. In fact, I was thinking the other day, Terry, I was talking about education, and one of the most successful education programs ever launched by the federal government in the wake of Sputnik in the late 50s, we trained a whole generation of engineers and scientists and foreign language specialists. It helped us right through the 60s and 70s with a whole generation of technical specialists. We called it the National Defense Education Act. and we pretended it was all about catching up with the Soviets in space. Or to take one other example, in the 1950s, we launched an interstate highway program that was vitally important for our economic development. Do you remember what we called it?
No.
The National Defense Highway Act. And we pretended that it was all about getting munitions rapidly from places like Boston to San Diego in the event of a national emergency. Well, it may have been about that, but it was also about our economic development as a nation. We need to understand that these investments, these public investments, are a critical part of capitalism. If we're going to be successful in the 21st century, every other factor of production, technology and corporations, planted equipment, money, they're all footloose. They go everywhere. But our skills, our education, and our infrastructure, that is our highways and bridges and transportation and communication linkages, those things are relatively immobile, and on those will depend our future standard of living.
Robert Reich is the author of the new book, The Work of Nations. Tomorrow, more on the meaning of the new global economy. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what stories do you have from Iraq today?
Well, we'll be hearing some of the accounts of refugees coming out of southern Iraq into the border region controlled by U.S. forces. And also we'll be taking a look at what's happening in the north of Iraq, where the Kurdish uprising is more successful than the Shiites are down south. We'll be hearing from reporter Jim Muir, who is inside Kurdish-controlled territory in Iraq, also from the Kurds' political spokesman about what they want from the United States at this point, and we'll be hearing what the United States is willing to do for them, which is far less than what they're asking.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A couple of weeks ago, we had Bret Easton Ellis on the show to talk about his controversial new novel, American Psycho. Then we called Tammy Bruce from the L.A. chapter of Now, who organized a boycott against the book's publisher. We've been curious to hear what our book critic, John Leonard, thinks of the novel.
I've read it, and you don't have to. Everybody associated with the hoopla ought to be ashamed. The same giant corporation that distributes Friday the 13th slasher movies decided that American Psycho was beyond the pale. Another giant corporation was obscenely quick to cash in on the publicity. The National Organization of Women called for a boycott of the offending publisher, as if to boycott our own minds, a kind of self-blinding. And what did anybody expect from Ellis anyway? In his first novel, the overpraised Less Than Zero, L.A. zombies cut off a young girl's breasts and stuck candles in her. Since his second novel, The Rules of Attraction, wasn't violent enough to sell many copies, he had to up the ante in his third. Meet Patrick Bateman, a 27-year-old Harvard-educated Wall Street broker. When Patrick, in his Ralph Lauren silk pajamas, isn't listening to Whitney Houston on his Sansui stereo system with the 6-foot Duntech Sovereign speakers, when he isn't eating quail sashimi and chocolate chip sorbet in the latest overpriced bistro, when he isn't snorting coke at the latest downtown armpit or forgetting to return his videos or on his way to a masseuse or a tanning salon, or buying magazines like Esquire and Lesbian Vibrator Bitches, what this Patrick does is torture dogs, pop the eyes out of homeless beggars, dismember yuppies, and get away with it. In spite of the inside references to Brat Pack buddies Jay McInerney and Tama Janowitz, not to mention Tom Wolfe, this might have been funny, a sort of Bonfire of the Vanities meets the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And for 200 pages, some of it actually is. Ellis has an ear for the homophobic and misogynistic fatuities of his social set, and an eye for their A. Testoni loafers and Oliver Peoples non-prescription glasses. Since everybody looks alike, they are always mistaking each other for somebody else. They are their accessories. And the television talk show Patrick watches each morning could also have been amusing had Ellis developed such topics as deformed people, dwarf tossing, teenage girls who trade sex for crack, and has Patrick Swayze become cynical or not. But Ellis wants to be profound. Not by accident, when Patrick tells people that he's, quote, into murders and executions, what they hear him say is mergers and acquisitions. When he makes obscene telephone calls to Dalton schoolgirls, what he whispers to them is, I'm a corporate raider. I orchestrate hostile takeovers. What do you think of that? In other words, when Psycho goes on in disgusting detail about the rape of an Aspen waitress with a can of hairspray, and the nailing of Bethany's fingers to a hardwood floor, and the sodomizing of a severed head, it's really a critique of late capitalism and the fetishism of commodities. Sure, and I'm the king of Bavaria. We can't tell a novelist what to write, but we can hold him accountable for his choices. If Ellis feels so bad about late capitalism, why not imagine a Patrick who, instead of killing folks, joins the Peace Corps or the Red Cross, goes to therapy or Tibet, maybe even becomes a nun? I'll tell you why not. Because not a single character in any Ellis novel has ever been capable of introspection, much less love, art, heroism, or politics. They're all zombies. American Psycho is no surprise. The mystery is why, among so many offensive books, we all chose to flog this one into bestsellerdom.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. Fresh Air's producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Our production assistants are Joan Tuohy, Roberta Shurrock, and Seuss Bolin. Research assistants from Ellen Silva, Susan Labadee, and Tracy Hildebrand. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and is performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, economist Robert Reich returns to give us his prescription for curing America's economic problems. Also, TV critic David Bianculli previews David Frost's interview with General Norman Schwarzkopf. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.